great honor to have Professor Mike Gasper to the Fellow of the American Society. And I guess most of you know Mike, you know very well. Mike is he's now in the City University in London, and he has many honors. You know, he's a Fellow of American Physical Society and Nehru Institute of Bengaluru in India, and also he's a actually Fellow of the Royal Society. And 2010, I'd like to mention that he was awarded the Hunter Ring from Germany, which is very, important recognition, especially in Germany viewpoint. And also he, in 2012, he was elected as an honorary fellow by the Royal Aerospace Society. So Mike is always modest in a way that he is saying about his research, his work is primarily on experiment, but he did many great theoretical work, and so he's actually in the outside of UK, he's also regarded as a good, very great theoretician, actually. Okay, this is the way that I have actually been educated from the country. Okay,
Thank you very much for that introduction. When I was invited to come here, I really wasn't sure what topic to choose to talk about. I thought I'd choose some more theoretical paper, but events of the last few weeks really have shown that laminar flow in the future might live. So I'm going to go through my view of what the development of possible laminar flow aircraft have been over the years. There are two messages that thread throughout this. One is, don't think of an idea that is so trivial because nobody will believe it works. That's the first thing. Don't make it too simple. Could be a piece of theory, but if it's so simple that a child could have thought of it, you won't be treated seriously. The second thing is to realize, as most of you do, that there are fashions in funding and in research. And laminar flow has been sort of an interest probably from the 1920s. And if you work in this area, you'll find that there's 10 or 15 years where you might well get some funding and some interest, and then it all falls apart. And you're considered a pariah working in such a useless field that has no practical value at all. And 10 years later, suddenly it all changes again. I'm sure this happens in all sorts of fields. This has been a long slog. And I just hope that the pictures are seeable. Yes, you can, but it's a pity we can't get these out. But the advanced technology that you have here doesn't apparently work. So you'll have to bear with me and see. Now this is a picture you all might have seen, and you know that the flow in the front of a wing is sort of laminar, and at some stage it gets turbulent. And we all believe that it's a jolly good idea if you could move the transition back, because you'll get lower drag. So that's really where we're starting from. And whether this is actually true or not, you've got to be very careful, because it's not the only drag component you've got there. You've got pressure drag as well, it can be much more. Now, when I was an undergraduate student, I was at Queen Mary, and the professor at Queen Mary was N.A.V. Pearcey, old school. He was one of the people who taught aerodynamics during the First World War there, so he has a long background and this sort of thing. And he was passionately interested in the idea of getting some laminar flow. He designed aerofoils, he had boundary layer methods and so on. He was a really pretty good guy. And he was very proud of the fact that one of his aerofoils that he had designed in the 30s by using some conformal mapping method, which moved the transition, the maximum thickness downstream, which they knew was beneficial. They tested that in the compressed air tunnel at the National Physical Laboratory. Compressed air tunnel could run at 30 atmospheres, so it had quite a high Reynolds number. And he told us more than once that the test showed that the drag of his aerofoil was less than a thin flat plate. He was terribly proud because the transition was moved further downstream and the pressure drag was very small because it was a decent aerofoil. And so there was some belief. Now this was, we're talking about 1930s. Now they actually, I believe, although there's no proof and there's no documents about this, but it sort of stated that the mosquito used one of Pierce's aerofoils. I tried to track this down and there is no evidence whatsoever that they did. If they did, there's no evidence that there was any laminar flow on there. But this was one of the things. If you're building an aeroplane like this, which is reasonably clean, can you get lower drag by shaping the wing very carefully? So this was 1940. Now, we were pretty busy for a few years during that period. But just after the war, there was renewed interest in whether you could build a laminar flow transport aircraft. And Hanley Page, Sir Frederick, was certainly one of the people who was keen to push this, and a lot of experiments were done at the National Physical Laboratory and other places on trying to get aerofoils with a bit more laminar flow. And this aircraft, can you actually see it, just about, was really rather an advanced flying wing test bed for that period. And that was supposed to have laminar flow on it. Well, they flew it around, and it's a very nice looking aeroplane. Then they did some experiments using evaporation technique, and you can see here that on this inboard section, you get laminar flow back to about there, then it goes turbulent. But when we look at the flow on the more highly swept bit, so here you can get some laminar flow, but here it's fully turbulent. So this was discovered about, oh, I suppose 1948, 49, something like that. And it was a great disappointment what was happening. Some experiments were done at Farnborough by a chap called Gray. They were classified. I never saw them. I still never seen them, actually, because he's died and they were never declassified. I think the Russians can see them, but I can't, apparently. That's actually true. They know all about the stuff. So I didn't know anything about it. But at this time, there was some theoretical activity to study what had gone wrong. What happens on a highly swept wing? Well, on a highly swept wing, the boundary layer profiles are distorted. They're twisted. If you calculate them, they're twisted. And some very smart people did stability analysis on that, and they, well, that's just to remind me, they then did some experiments on a rotating disc. And a rotating disc has profiles that are very similar to those on swept leading edges. And the rotating disc, as you can see, produces these striations, which are vortices on the surface, and then the outer part goes turbulent. And they reckon that this is what was happening on the swept leading edges. You can cure that by suction. So all is not lost. We now do some more development work on aircraft with leading edge suction. So we're now moving forward to about 1960. In 1960, Northrop designed and built two X-21 transonic aircraft that were supposed to be command posts. So they would be refueled and would be waiting up there to press the button to launch Armageddon somewhere whenever it was required. And it was quite important for these things to be efficient. So low drag, let's have laminar flow. Feniger was a passionate believer. It's like a religion with him. Laminar flow is going to be the answer. He had worked on suction work, I think, for his PhD, and he always worked on things like this. He was really believed it was the future. The other project was Hanley Page. And Hanley Page had a research director called Gustav Lachmann, very interesting man. Lachmann was actually a First World War German pilot who crashed. And he ended up in hospital. He was actually an aeronautical engineer. And he wondered why he crashed. He knew he'd stalled. And he worked out how to get over this with some leading edge slat. Then he discovered that Hanley Page had patented it. So he came over to work with Hanley Page, and he stayed. So, but he was a fairly ferocious individual, complete with a limp and dueling scars. We were all terrified of him, but he led the Hanley Page project. And he and Feniger, there was quite a joint connection. This is the Northrop aeroplane that flew in about 1963, Mach number 0.75. Quite an advanced idea with laminar flow over sort of 95-100% of the wing. Pretty advanced, actually. Ours was a much simpler thing. There was a belief at that time, which is probably not true at all, that you can't do experiments on swept wings in a wind tunnel because the turbulence is too high. And therefore, you have to do it in flight. Cranfield had done some experiments with a swept wing on an Anson and been able to measure laminar turbulent transition and so on. And so it was the natural place to do this work. So this is a Lancaster bomber that belonged to Ministry of Defense or somebody. The wing was made by Hanley Page, and we mounted it at Cranfield and did the flight experiments. So that wing has a number of suction slots, about a tenth of a millimeter wide, 100 slots on each side, and some round the nose to stop this so-called cross-flow instability. Now, I had nothing to do with this. I was working at Cranfield. I was in the aerodynamics division, and although I was interested in laminar flow, I didn't honestly believe that this was going to be a great success, and it was run by flight test department, nothing to do with us at all, except that my boss was Professor Lilly, and Jeff Lilly was very involved with this, and they started to produce some results, and they found that they couldn't get laminar flow as designed with the suction on all over the wing. They could get laminar flow at the tip. Towards the tip, they could get laminar flow about 70% back. But near the root, transition was much too early, and you increased the suction, it didn't work. And so the belief was that this was acoustics. After all, you've got four Rolls-Royce Merlins there whirling away. Perhaps they make too much noise. Noise was known to affect the thing. So I was detailed to measure the sound on the aeroplane, which I duly did. I made a microphone mounting, streamlined, and flew and collected a lot of data. But while I was doing that, of course, I saw what the guys were doing, and being me, I was very critical of it. They measured, I mean, it's difficult in flight, it's not the same as in the laboratory. How do you measure what's happening? Well, they had cones, Peter cones, that they could actually traverse. It was quite advanced in that way. You could move the cones around. The pressures from the pitot tubes were taken to a water manometer in the aeroplane. And that was then photographed. You had to tell the engine driver to go nice and steady. They were photographed, and then the next day, the films were developed, and you could measure up and draw a profile, and you can say, oh, we get transition here, or we don't there. Well, that's ridiculous. You want to be able to tell straight away. So I was terribly critical of this. I said, surely we can find a better way. So they said, all right, clever makers, do it. So I tried microphones, but the engine noise was so loud that I couldn't pick up anything of flow. And then somebody suggested, it wasn't my idea, somebody suggested, can't you do something with a hot film or something like that? Somebody had already done some experiments where they had evaporated a metal film on a quartz wedge or something, and they'd put that in the wind tunnel and measured something. So we made little hot films. These were made out of microscope slides, like a little chisel. And at the end, I painted a platinum material on, fired it in a furnace, and used that as a detector. And straight away, you could see. So you can see a laminar situation, one with turbulent spots and turbulence. You can't measure anything with these things. It's really an indicator, let's be fair. It's not no better than that. But it gave us the chance of actually being able to see what was happening while you were flying. So I made large numbers of these, covered all over the wing, and we could sit in the aeroplane and plug things in and look on an oscilloscope. This is just an oscilloscope, single oscilloscope held on the aircraft. You could go through it. And the pilot, to get different Reynolds numbers, he would try and climb and then go into a gradual dive, and you could get a whole range of speeds like that. You could also alter the suction by, there was a gas turbine mounted in the bomb bays, and you could alter the suction valves and so on. Actually, none of this made any difference at all. The flow was turbulent near the route. We're talking about halfway down that wing, was turbulent. And at this stage, there was another lesson that we should all learn. Dr. Lachman had issued instructions that we should do measurements near the trailing edge of the wing and find out how much laminar flow, what speed we could get laminar flow at 90% chord. And I moved the gauges forward because I wanted to know what was happening. We didn't fly that frequently. It's not like doing a wind tunnel experiment. Probably we only had one or two flights a week, because you have to get the engine driver and he has to be happy that he can see far enough. Everything has to come together. It's not straightforward. So you plan a flight, the weather's right, you no clouds and all this sort of thing, you can fly. You might not be able to do it again tomorrow. But I was moving the gauges steadily forward, and he came along for a meeting, and he was furious. And I said, well, why do you want it at the back? Because I know you'll get laminar flow at the route, very slow speed. He said, we have a shareholders meeting next week. I want to tell the shareholders that we can get 90% laminar flow. And I, being young and stupid, completely ignored his instructions and moved the gauges further forward, because every time I moved them forward, still turbulent at the same Reynolds number, and eventually they were right on the leading edge. And that's when we saw that the phenomenon wasn't transition as we used to see it. Something else is happening. And I put forward the idea that we had turbulence from the route that was relaminarizing on the leading edge. And that point of relaminarization was just moving along at different speeds. Well, of course, this is sort of didn't go down very well. The only person I think who believed me was Professor Lilly, and he was very supportive. But generally, certainly the Hanley Page people didn't believe this. So we did one flight. Well, that's what happens. The flow comes along at some angle, sweeps along the leading edge, and you have a particular boundary layer. You can solve the problem, has a particular Reynolds number, and this is not very clear. It's even less clear because the lights are on. But this was one experiment we did where the guy who was organizing this put up a whole lot of wires so that he could have trip wires and at a certain time pull that trip wire off and measure transition. And he had hot films that you could pull off. So we could use different parts of the wing to get different radius, and then we flew at different altitudes to change the air density, and the argument was we're going to get a critical Reynolds number where it behaves like this, and that Reynolds number is not going to depend on where we are on the wing. It is a unique Reynolds number. It's not bad. I mean, it was very nice to do this in flight with your slide rule and work it out and plot it. So when we had finished this epic flight, which took 2.5 hours, because the Lancaster took a long time to get to 22,000 feet, you don't realize how slow and lumbering aircraft were in those days. This sort of demonstrated that there was a critical Reynolds number. To go further and demonstrate that this was the phenomenon we're talking about, the natural thing was to go into the wind tunnel. And the wind tunnel at Cranfield, there was an 8-foot wind tunnel, and I got immediate access to it without any money. None of this business of you can't use the wind tunnel, you haven't got a contract. It was considered important to do it. So we made a model very quickly, put the wind tunnel, put in the wind tunnel, and were able to show that, yes, it was relaminarization. So having done a lot of experiments to show that it was this difficulty, the next question, how do you cure it? How do you prevent this contamination? Well, being a sort of rather practical person, I got a lump of plasticine and stuck it on the leading edge. And that is a typical thing. And the idea of my bump was that the flow would come along and there would be a new stagnation point about here somewhere. A new flow would go over the top and all the turbulent flow would go around the side. I don't know whether that's what happened, but I built this plasticine bump, smoothed it out, and blow me down, we got laminar flow. Now, Hanley Page, of course, didn't like this because they had their own design for curing this. So they wouldn't allow me to put this on the aeroplane until they had gone through a whole sequence of tests on their own designs. Didn't work, I'm pleased to say. And then they said, right, use your lump of plasticine. So I went on to the wing, put the plasticine lump on. Pilot was very unhappy at flying with a lump of plasticine stuck on the wingtip. But it was actually quite difficult to do because I had to do it in situ, standing on top of a cherry picker. You're about 40 foot off the ground. Swaying. It wasn't easy. Fly? Didn't work. Not like a wind tunnel where you just go, oh, I'll shake the plasticine. So, 2 days later, had another go. Didn't work. One more time. Thank God the last time. I don't know, I made a slight change. It worked. This is, so what we did was then take a plaster cast of that, make a polyester model that was actually fixed onto the wing. And so this actually cured the problem, but it's not ideal. It doesn't have very high incidence tolerance. As the stagnation point moves around the wing, it fails. And after this, I found that it actually fails at some Reynolds number. It only saves you, I don't know, a factor of 2 in Reynolds. That's quite. I mean, it solved our problem, and so on. So this was at that stage. So it was patented by Power Jets Limited. Everybody thought it was a huge joke, but nevertheless, I wondered whether putting something like that on a wing, which would then give you a laminar leading edge, might well be beneficial anyway. Forget laminar flow. Could you get some laminar flow on the nose and therefore get slightly less drag? We'll come on to that. The Northrop project was cancelled. And because of this, the UK effort in laminar flow plummeted down to zero. Now, why did the Northrop project fail? It failed because they had lots of filler between bits of metal and bits of suction panel. And every flight, when you get up to altitude and it gets damn cold, come down again, it cracks. So they had technicians polishing and rubbing it. The military didn't like that. This was a military project. They said, no, military project's got to work. We don't want any of this titivating. And of course, then it failed. So these were prototypes. It was ridiculous to expect that to work. In fact, our aeroplane had a soft mastic between the nose and the main body. Every single flight when we got down was a crack. And I had proposed changing that soft joint, but they didn't want to do it. So the young lad from Hanley Page, who was the other experimenter, and I went up to Cranfield one weekend. We took out all the mastic, filled it with David's isopon, resprayed the wing. Nobody was in the wiser. We didn't get any more cracks. But it was quite important to do that because you never knew whether the crack was there before, you know, at altitude before you did the test or on the way down. You just saw the evidence that there was a bad joint. So we wanted to get over that. But at that stage, this is 1965, the whole of the idea of working on laminar flow was killed. And I joined the National Physical Laboratory, and I remember on day one somebody saying, well, I mean, it's a complete waste of time, the efforts you guys were putting into laminar flow. We know all we need to know to make our wind tunnel experiments turbulent. We know the ballottini we have to put on. Well, what else do you need to know? You'll never get laminar flow. Wasting your time, waste of government money, etc. That was very much the attitude. Quite aggressive, actually, I remember. And the people working in this area at the National Physical Laboratory, one of those, a very good friend of mine, Tony Davey, was shortly after this transferred to helicopters. You can't do that with people working on things like this. It doesn't work. It didn't work. He left. He went somewhere else. But it was considered laminar flow is dead. Shortly after that, I think 1970, I was at a conference in Moscow, and I met Dr. Feniger. And Dr. Feniger said he was on the way to Novosibirsk, where they were starting to do experiments in laminar flow and transition. I am going to tell them everything, he said, everything. And you will see that in a few years, the American government will not want to be left behind, and I'll be back in business. And he was absolutely right. And I saw him a few years later at NASA Langley, because Northrop had then gone. He was working at Langley on transonic, laminar flow experiments, and it was all coming up again. There was more funding, and so on. Now, the funding in this country actually had reached a low, and I didn't sort of recover at all at that time. 20 years on, so we're talking now 1980s, 1985, Airbus planned to do experiments on the fin of an A320. They wanted to see if they could get some laminar flow along the leading edge, which might well go back a decent distance. They'd done some calculations and it looked sort of possible. Well, they needed to use a bump to stop the contamination. So I put in a proposal to do that, but of course it was turned down, and the Honora designed Legaster bump, which was partially successful but didn't work at very high Reynolds numbers. So the bump has been used by, on the Hanley Page thing, was used by NASA on the Lockheed Jetstar, and in actual fact they had a copy of my plaster mold, which I gave them. So that's where it came from. Dassault used it on the Falcon. I don't know where they did any tests. And then Boeing used it on the 757 glove, slightly differently. They obviously had problems getting it to work because they had suction as well, suction on the nose of this thing. And then the A320 fin. And then, of course, more recently, Boeing 787 has got a notch on it. So there's the Jetstar. And if you look closely, you can see the notched bump there that was apparently successful. But this is why I decided to give you a talk. Whether you know about this, this flew 3 weeks ago for the first time. This is a big European project. A lot of money has gone into it. It's a 340 with different outboard wings. The outboard section is swept at 20 degrees. There is a belief that it'll get some laminar flow on it. I've had nothing to do with this. It's very irritating, actually, that one doesn't know what's going on. But this is a close-up of the wing, and you might be able to see that something looks like a bump there. We can go a bit closer. Airbus claim this is a completely new device. I have no proprietary rights. The patent ran out about 50 years ago. But it does look awful similar. The interesting thing is that I will now show you the more recent device that I thought about. They wouldn't use that, although Airbus own it, because this is tried and tested. So the bump fails when the Reynolds number gets greater than about 170. In about 1992, I did, when I was at Cambridge, some very simple experiments on a thing that I called bleeding slot, and showed that it worked. I'll show you pictures of it in a minute. The interesting thing is, no one showed the least interest. I wrote letters to all the people who were active in potential laminar flow. I wrote to Airbus and so on. I wrote to NASA Langley. They were the only people who showed any interest in a new device. But they didn't follow it up, of course. For some odd reason, I was at BAE Filton, and somehow it came up in conversation. I said, well, you know, you guys will lose out if you don't. They owned Airbus at the time, BAE. If you don't take up my great new invention, a sort of jokey thing. Oh, could you tell us about it? So we had a meeting, I told them about it, and we decided to do some experiments. It took 3 years before we got in the wind tunnel. The program apparently was cancelled twice, but nobody told me. Eventually, we got in the wind tunnel. This is the 12-foot leading edge. This is in the 10-foot wind tunnel at Filton, and this is highly swept. You can sweep it while you're running. It's on the turntable. It's just a cylinder, beautiful metal cylinder with a streamlined tail. Just the job we wanted for it. And this is the device, which, as I say, is childish. And this is the problem. People don't like things that are childish. So all this does is it takes the turbulent flow from here, it goes under there, out through the side where the pressure is a little bit lower because it's round the cylinder, and you start a new laminar flow on the top. Can this really work? Yeah, actually it's terribly easy. So why not use it? So we did a whole series of tests, and that's just showing some oil flow, and then I designed a fancier one that I thought looked nicer, and we ran up to full speed of the tunnel and all the sort of thing, right up to the critical Reynolds number of the flow. So this would go up to a Reynolds number of 2,500. That is 2.5 times the Reynolds number of the bump, which is quite significant, actually, because of the square roots and things that come out. It means you can go an awful lot faster. It also has an enormous incidence tolerance. It's very simple, can be retrofitted. Airbus offered to buy it, but the return was paltry. So I thought, I'll sell it to somebody. Kinetic were interested because they were wanting to acquire patents at the time. And they felt that they needed to do numerical work to see whether any laminar flow at the front would actually be beneficial. Chris Atkin did the calculations, actually, and 2 years later, I got the calculations, which showed that the laminar boundary layer is very much thinner. The skin friction is almost the same as the turbulent boundary layer. However, when you looked at the calculations very carefully, you could see that the momentum thickness at the trailing edge was 5 or 6% thinner when you had a laminar leading edge. That must mean something. So the skin friction does not go down. They looked at the skin friction and they said, you're not going to save anything. We're not interested. Okay. The next thing was Queen Mary wanted to take out a provisional patent because of the ref. All right, take out the provisional patent. I didn't actually make any money in the first year, and so they decided to drop the project. Now, what you do with a patent, you take out some provisional patent, and then you have to take out the bigger patent, I don't know, it's a year or something like that. And that's where the money comes in. You have to spend money for the next stage. And they weren't prepared to spend the money, so I bought the patent for £1, and I paid the patent fees. I was just annoyed that this had gone no further. Taking out patents for things like this is a real pain, if anybody has ideas on that. And the poor woman who was looking after this activity was very worried that I was spending all my pension money. And she said that you never, very rarely does anybody ever make anything out of small patents like this. And the problem is that you have to go on paying. You have to take out patents in all, I think, 9 countries in the end. So the amount of money escalates, and there's no clear return. So at this point, DTI, head of DTI innovation branch or something, decided to have a meeting to bring somebody from Airbus, and Norman Wood came along. He listened to me and he said, Mike, it almost certainly won't work. If it did work, the gains would be nothing like you predict, or Chris predicts. And thirdly, we break patents like this every day. I was furious. But nevertheless, that was DTI's view. I then gave an invited talk at an AIAA meeting on laminar flow in Seattle. I got a pretty rough treatment from Boeing. They thought it was a huge joke that you could do something as trivial as this and actually save drag. However, one person, Stephen Rolston, who some of you know, actually very quietly phoned me up, didn't make any fuss at the meeting, and said, I think we ought to talk about this and let's see what we can do. So we planned another series of experiments in the Filton Tunnel. It took another 3 years before we got in the tunnel. So look at the time scale of this. This is ridiculous. And we did indeed get quite a big drag saving, which made him smile. He was sweating blood when we were doing the experiment, because initially it didn't work. This is the device. This is all you have to put on. That was a half-size wing, something like that. That's a titanium. So there's a whole series of them that we try, different lengths, different heights. It didn't seem to make any difference, actually. In 2014, Airbus bought the patent, and I was promised, and this is another warning for all you people who are going along this line, I was promised to be kept within the loop and would see what was happening. Cut out completely. The next thing I heard that DLR were doing flight tests. And I only heard that from a third party who had been to DLR and seen the aeroplane. And I also heard that the people doing the 340 experiments wouldn't use this because it was untested. I just don't understand. Conclusions are that laminar leading edges are essential for wings designed to support large regions of laminar flow. You have to do it one way or another. You can do it with suction, but this is a cheaper way of doing it. And if you have a turbulent wing and you make the leading edges laminar, you will get a thinner boundary layer, you will get lower drop, you will actually get a weaker shock as well, if you're thinking about that. And that may be that your buffet boundary improves, and it's actually well known that laminar leading edges produce a higher seal max. And they do that because the boundary layer is thinner, the rear separation, which is usually the thing that limits your seal max, you can go to more rear loading. Profile drag reductions of about 5% have been predicted, which on an aeroplane means like 1%, 0.8, something like that. So I do believe that there is a possibility that we may have made a little bit of drag savings. But it's incredible how difficult it is to persuade anybody that a bent piece of tin can actually be beneficial. The people like Steve Ralston in the research group were much more amenable to this. When you then move over and talk to the wing designers, it's very difficult. Go to Airbus airplane designers. You know, you academics don't understand the problems at all. Well, we don't understand a lot of the problems, that's certainly true. And you don't realize the difficulty of this, the difficulty of that, and so on. So they're very negative about every aspect of this. It's really quite extraordinary how difficult it is. So if you do design some simple bent bit of tin, make it curly or something so it looks a little bit more grandiose. A simple bent curved bit of plate did not do me any good at all, actually. So you have to be careful of that. And then when you actually try and sell them something, you have to make sure that your contractual side of it is tightly tied up. Otherwise, they will stitch you up. Thank you.
Any questions?
Just one comment. The Ruth Balthagar, you know, probably.
Sorry?
The Ruth Balthagar, who probably you know from Airbus, maybe?
Yes, yes, yes.
Once told me that the problem is that he gets about 5 proposals a day.
Yes, probably.
And that's what breeds skepticism in the industrialist mind.
Yeah.
The sheer tsunamis of proposals they get, which they view with great skepticism, and they know that of course to install anything on an aircraft costs a lot of money.
Yes, absolutely. But saving 1% of the drag, or even 0.5% of the drag, is worth gold dust.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you have to
dig a lot of gold, dig a lot of rock in order to get...
The interesting thing was dealing with all these corporations. You write a very balanced, I hope, sensible letter, and you send it off, and you get no reply at all from 99% of the people you've sent the letter to. They are terrified that if they say, yes, come and see us, we can talk about this, they've committed themselves to the thing. If they say, get lost, this is not going to work, and it turns out that Boeing buy it, so they pretend they don't get the letter. It's quite extraordinary, actually. But that was my experience of this. So whether you can enter into this discussion with a company through some intermediary, I don't know. But trying to do it as an individual is virtually impossible. I did sell it for $250,000, actually. So I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
Yeah. Is this the latest form of the device? Because I seem to remember in the news 3-4 years ago a much more streamlined, curvy.
There was one, yes, the people at Filton who have rapid prototype machines have made some out of nylon that wrapped round the the wing that were rather nice. I haven't brought one of those here, but this is the more recent one, which is made out of titanium, which they feel is more suitable. I don't know why it is. I was going to use a piece of sheet metal again, but they wanted to make it a bit flashy. Yes.
I think almost anything will work, actually.
The leading edge bump you measured is not successful when our theta is greater than 170?
Yes, right.
Yes, right. Yes, yes. What is the reading the reason for?
I don't know. And I know people at Honora didn't find out either, and they were quite perturbed that they couldn't get up to high Reynolds number. Should be able to get up to 250, which is the natural instability of the attachment line. But we could never, I couldn't do that in my wind tunnel anyway, but they could at Honora, and they actually couldn't get there, and I talked to them, they didn't know why. I don't know why either, I don't know how it works actually. But the fact that it did work, it got us out of a problem at Cranfield, and other people also felt this got them out of the problem. But you really need, I mean, I'd like to see DNS on a shape like that. That was part of my proposal, to take a family of shapes and actually see what the flow did, and see whether from that we could find out which family worked and which didn't, and so on. But I think they've done DNS on the slot. I think that has been computed and shown, yes, you do get a clean flow over the top, but it's not a critical shape at all. So you can do it just by common sense. Now, whether the Airbus 340 has been wind tunnel tested, because in my view, the bump thing they've got there is too close to the streamlined separator between the two sections. So I'm very skeptical as to whether it'll work, but I can't believe they've gone to those lengths of building this sort of aeroplane without doing appropriate wind tunnel tests or something, but I don't know. I mean, we will find out eventually, I suppose. We'll hear how successful they've been. But if they get laminar flow, they're claiming they want to get laminar flow back to about 50%. The aeroplane, instead of going at a Mach number that modern aeroplanes go at, will have to go down to about 0.75, which is not terribly much slower. But the gains that they're looking for, I think, are about 10%. On fuel burn, which is quite a lot. If they can get 10%, they're doing jolly well.
Any questions?
Well, I was going to ask, how many of these have we got to buy? I mean, if it's 380, do we need to keep putting them?
You need one at every slat. You need about four.
Okay.
That's all. Yeah.
I mean, you don't get any out of that.
They haven't shown any interest in putting this on larger aeroplanes like the 350. 380, the outboard section, you could certainly gain quite a bit. But I have mentioned it, but I was told we're thinking about it. That's all. But any ideas you have for doing something like this, I can tell you it's a pain to push it through for a period of about 30 years. Didn't break up my marriage, but there were occasions where you start to become obsessive about it, and you start to feel that the world is against you, which it is, of course. it's all trivial. The bent piece of tin. Let's be sensible about it. But the fact that people won't listen is infuriating. I mean, I'm sure you've all found that with other things. That if you do a little piece of theory that is very, very simple and explains something, you'll find nobody listens to that either. This is true.
Stop here. So let's thank Mike for a very